So we're going to do a really brief theoretical motivation because you guys are theorists and there's no reason for us to talk about that. And then we're going to really talk about experimental design drivers for light mass dark matter. And I really feel this is like the things that you really need to know and understand of like what are the backgrounds for these experiments, how does recoil energy scale with mass, things of that ilk. And then we will swap over to other things, which is atomic photon detection technology. Again, what the R&D status is currently, and how we envision our energy resolution, for example, to improve time over the next 5 years. Okay, so always stop me whenever. This is a casual setting with a small number of people, so we can be very cool. Okay, so 10 years ago, almost all of the experimental community was focused on WIMPs, of course. And you know, we didn't see WIMPs, and so now we did start to broaden the area to look for. And today, really, there is this idea that we should search for dark matter everywhere, in particular, all the way down with axions down to the very, very, very small masses. But I'm really going to focus this talk on this energy scale, which is a challenging energy scale one has because one doesn't have that much coherence in the dark matter itself. So you really are looking for single events. And so it looks more like a standard traditional high energy experiment rather than DM radio. So this is what we have here. You see LZ here and you see super city mass. We're really talking about going down in this direction. So what are the challenges here and what are the design drivers? So there's some cool things that we see. The first is that the experimental rate that we expect in our detector, it of course it scales with the number of like atoms you have in your experiment, and it scales with a bunch of other things, of course the cross-section, and the number density of dark matter. And if we rewrite that as the mass density, which is what we measure in our galaxy, then we see it goes as 1/m. So as we go to smaller masses, we just have more dark matter floating around, more dark matter going through your experiment per second. And that means that it gets easier as we go down here to actually see it. So in particular, you can just think of this in terms of LZ. LZ needs something like 10 tons to get to 10⁻⁷ at 100 GV. But because it's 1/m, a light mass dark matter with the same cross section would only need 10 kilograms. So it really converts us from a traditional large scale high energy experiment. As we go lower and lower in mass, it really takes us to tabletop experiments.
The utility of this plot becomes less and less as you go to the left, right? If you talk about the heavy particles, like say TV, then such plot is the only thing you have, right? Well, once you have gone to something like scales of particles that can be produced in stars and so on, you really need to know
how
to interact.
So certainly there are other astronomical limits as you go to low mass. So for the scalar interaction shown here on nucleons, below 1 MeV, it gets really constrained. Below 1 MeV. Above 1 MeV, there's some space still. So I think down to the 1 MeV scale, this plot is okay, but I totally agree that there are other plots. I'm just showing it's wide open down there in the first order. Oh, yes. Sorry.
Okay, so now let's look at the kinematics. And you guys have all seen this. So if I am just scattering a dark matter particle, which is much lighter than the nucleus, this is equivalent to me throwing a rubber ball against a wall. The wall is very massive. I don't give very much kinetic energy to the wall. The wall doesn't fly backwards. The kinetic energy mostly stays with the ball. Very little is given to the wall. And actually, you can sort of see this right here in terms of momentum transfer. And you can even see that the momentum scales, the energy given scales as m squared dark matter. And we see that down there. So what is it? So it really means that because the recoil energy scales with the mass squared of the dark matter, as we go to lower and lower masses, which are much smaller than the nucleus we use, the recoil energies get really, really tiny. And we see that here. Here is this m squared law for the average kinetic energy in a nuclear recoil. And if you really want to probe down to milli-EV scales, down to MeV dark matter, which again, below here, at least in this for scalar nucleus interactions, it's not very likely. But if you really want to use this technique to go down to 1 MeV, you're looking at saying, I need to see milli-EV scale recoils. So what, and that just means the energy sensitivity is the primary driver of any of this detector technology. So let's actually now take that scale and let's just look at what this means. So what are the standard scales of physics? So electronic band gap is like EV scales. And if you want to make a Frenkel defect, so if you want to move a nucleus in like a silicon atom, or basically in any crystal, it's the 10 EV scale-ish level to move that nucleus from a site on the crystal somewhere else. So it's roughly 15 EV, 10, 15 EV. And like that actually tells you right there that ionization production really has a lower limit that's hard. And this doesn't even assume like Linhart yield suppression, because we actually know that if you do go above the Frenkel defect state, that nucleus is traveling very slowly. So it's not going to perturb the electrons that much. So there's going to be very little ionization produced. But still, we can just set a limit and we can say, you know, below something like, you know, 500 MeV or so, 500 MeV, we don't expect any ionization in any kind of detector. So this is just one of those things that we really don't expect us to look for nuclear recoils below something like 500 MeV dark matter with an ionization detector. So we don't expect Sensei to work here. We don't expect us to be able to use your standard, scintillation detector in this area, because we'll just never make a photon. We'll never make a free electron. Okay, so that's the bad side. We can't use ionization detectors. We can't use systems of PMTs. What is the good side? Well, and we have these incredibly small recoil energies we're looking for. We already talked about one good side, is that we have a huge amount of dark matter going through your detector. That's one great point. So the second thing is that flat radiogenic backgrounds don't matter at all. So this is a plot of here, roughly. This is the differential background rate from tritium and Compton's that we would expect in something like a clean cryostat. So that's actually the expected super CDMS background level. And here is your coherent neutrino scattering CNS from neutrinos from the sun going above it. And then on this plot, I show you some dark matter of various masses. And what we see is that as we go to lower and lower mass, we already saw all the recoils are in a smaller and smaller region, so they get peaky. So there's no overlap there's much less overlap between the 0.2 GeV, the 200 MeV dark matter, and this high energy Compton background, which is relatively flat.
What's the minimum mass of a dark matter detector that would detect the PP neutrino coherent scattering with, say, one event per year?
So luckily I show you, actually, here is the PP line. And so the differential rate is 10, and it's over 10 per kV. So 1, 2, 3, 4, let's just say it is something like 5 EV. So that's 200. So something like 200. So it's something like 20 kilograms with a 5 EV threshold, circa, could see your PP neutrino. That's what this is saying. So that's a nice side product of this plot. It wasn't what the plot was made for, but yeah, you can just read it off. I think this idea that your traditional backgrounds that we care about in LZ don't matter to first order because they're much higher energy scale, and we're only looking at the bottom tail. So this is not completely true. There are some backgrounds that aren't flat and bump up at low energy. And so, for example, you have coherent photon scattering off of the entire nucleus. So you have a high energy photon coming in, scatters off the nucleus, kicks back out, and the whole nucleus goes flying. So that nucleus, again, has a very high mass compared to that photon. So it's given very little recoil energy. And you can roughly see that, again, as you go below something like EV scales, those these things start to dominate. But again, they're of order, this background, by a bit. And the answer is we can suppress these by just building a totally active photon veto. So if you surround your very light mass dark matter detector with a 4 pi active veto, I don't know, it could be neon if you wanted to go really 4 pi. Probably what we would do, just because we run crystals, is we would put some sodium iodide slabs in all around our crystal. You have to make that slab pretty thick to catch the high energy photon. So it would be like a 3.5-4 inch thick slab of sodium iodide on all sides. But these backgrounds can be suppressed by something like order 100 we've seen in simulation. So we expect we can suppress this background. So again, we don't think this should be a problem. So now the other thing you saw on this plot was that as you go to light masses, you see that the kinematic matching between helium is better than germanium. So for you get more energy out of a scatter on helium than you do for germanium for light mass. This is expected. So this is the whole concept behind like Harold and all these ideas of let's use helium as our hydrogen as our material to scatter off of. So let's look at the downsides to that. So there's good and downsides. So the reason to use helium and hydrogen is you get more energy out. So that's totally true. So the bad side is that is here. It's shown here. So this is the rate above your threshold. So light nuclei just have smaller coherent rate enhancements. So if you use helium and you have a low energy threshold, it's much worse than if you use, germanium. You just get much more signal because you have quantum coherence across the entire nucleon. So this is a disadvantage to using a lighter atom and a lighter nucleus. So, and then that actually gets swapped again, in that if you're looking for nuclear recoils, your electron recoil background, is roughly the same because it just depends on how many electrons you have in some volume, and that just scales with the mass, because for every to first order, for every proton you have an electron, so your electron recoil background rate is roughly going to be the same. If you use helium or if you use germanium, but your nuclear recoil rate is going to go down relative to this electron recoil rate. So if you really are going to be, so you're more sensitive to your electron recoil backgrounds when you're looking for a nuclear recoil when it's a lighter mass dark matter particle. So those are the two negatives you have. So if you're running, so if you're going to do a search with helium, you're going to be more sensitive to electron recoil backgrounds than if you use germanium. And it's because that ratio of electron recoil backgrounds to nuclear recoil backgrounds, it goes against you. On the other hand, you have a bigger signal. So those are the two trade-offs you have to use. Okay. So now let's go and look at this plot again. So I showed this plot as if we were just doing two-body elastic scattering. But if we're using crystals, and except for helium, germanium, silicon, oxygen, we have all these coherent vibration scales. And in all of these detectors, they're basically at 100 milliev scales. So we know right there that this idea of two-body elastic scattering is just not viable below here. So below something like 10 MeV, we really have to have a different model. We have to start looking at phonon production. Dark matter comes in, interacts with the crystal, shoots out a phonon. We can't think of these things as little atoms anymore. And so broadly, we have two different style of phonons. So we have acoustic phonons, and that's what we traditionally think of. And here, those are shown here. So actually, our sensitivity almost all comes from the longitudinal acoustic branch in all of our crystals. And that would be when the entire unit cell is going up and down together. And we'll contrast this to the optical phonons in a second. And basically, here's your dispersion relation. It's basically linear. Momentum and energy scale with each other with the sound speed of the velocity. And all crystals roughly have spacings of 5 angstroms. So roughly, that means you have momentums between 0 and like a few keV. So that's your momentum scale for your crystal.
And it's just from the longitudinal, just because of the higher sound speed?
No, it's more, well, so for scalar interactions, so I guess you could think of, so here, I guess I was wrong. So if you think of a dark photon, then it's going to make things bounce like this, and it'll couple to like transverse. But if you're looking at acoustic, like scalar interactions, just bangs, it's going to be a longitudinal acoustic. Okay, so now let's look at these kinematics. So these kinematics are different. You can just go through the kinematics, and you see that your energy scale is different. So it doesn't scale as m squared anymore. It scales as just m, and it scales as the acoustic velocity that we see. So this right there actually tells us something immediately, that we should, if we're looking for acoustic phonons, we should try to bump that sound speed up, because it'll give us the biggest energies we see. And yeah, so we should use diamond, we should use silicon dioxide, crystals with large energy scales. And it scales better. So let's look at this plot. So here is roughly how I think of it. So up here at high mass, we again have two-body elastic scattering. And then here at low mass, we start coming up, and we have a single acoustic phonon production. And then now here at something around an MeV scale, the momentum transfer is of a few kVc. So we can't do a hard phonon scatter anymore. So above that, we have to go to multi-phonon processes, or we just have soft phonon production. So just soft phonon where the dark matter is only kicked a little bit and releases a phonon, a very small phonon at right angles. And so that's roughly, I would think, how one should think about acoustic phonon production. So here are some phonon sensitivity curves. This was made by Catherine and Sinead just recently for a wide variety of different materials. This plot actually doesn't have, so this is for a heavy mediator. This is for a scalar interaction on a nucleus. And right here, there are no other sensitivity, there are no astrophysical bounds. But you can roughly see that the astrophysical bounds cut in right around the MeV scale. So this part of the plot really is already constrained. And you really have to just be looking in this range, somewhere around in MeV to 0.1 MeV, you can start to have a sensitivity space.
Sorry, in the plot that's in the bottom, you have a scalar mediator, right?
Yep.
And there, what is the excluded region? Because you have the supernova bound as well there.
Yep.
So I'm confused about what is allowed and what is
so allowed. Roughly, it's this space that's allowed.
Okay.
And this space. So this is not allowed. So I don't exactly know how the supernova.
It's excluded by above it, right? There is a thermalization.
Yes.
And to the left, everything is excluded. It's normal star. Stars will start getting normal thermal, so kind of the conductivity or lose energy this way, right?
Yeah. So there is, but there's a decent amount of parameter space in there, and so we should really try to develop codes so we can certainly go in this range with single phonon sensitivity devices. And here you roughly see the scale that one would need. Here is your thresholds. So these are a bunch of different crystals with 500 milliev experimental thresholds, and you're just being cut off. So now you're not in the single phonon sensitivity. As you switch to 100 milliev thresholds, you actually see that a lot of these detectors have no. So the lead tellurium just has no sensitivity, and it's because there are no single phonons at 100 milliev, and you're getting all of your reach by sapphire, which does have some phonons up there, sapphire and calcium tungstate.
And what's the background assumption? Good assumption, simple.
So the claim here is that, I guess the first word, and we'll talk about this in the experimental slides,
okay.
Is that what we would say traditional high energy physics backgrounds, so radiogenic backgrounds, with a 4 pi active veto, you can basically, we believe we should be able to suppress them all with current technology, that we all use, developed at SNOW, developed by LZ, developed by all these very high mass double beta decay and dark matter experiments. and it should be plenty fine. When we transition over to low mass, it really our backgrounds become detector physics. If you're running Sensei, what is their dominant background, or HVV? It's charge leakage going across your crystal, right? So that's a completely different idea of background. That's just detector physics problems. And so that's what limits us at low energies. It's not what I would say. So I think in that sense, the no background is both a bad assumption if you think of detector backgrounds, but it's a good assumption if you think of just radiogenic backgrounds that we traditionally think of for high energy experiments. So far I've talked about acoustic phonons, in which, so here for example is let's say gallium arsenide, which has a gallium and an arsenide in the unit cell. And an acoustic phonon is when both those particles are moving up and down coherently. So when I go like this, both particles are going up and down together. So of course there's another vibrational regime, and that's the optical phonons, which they go like this. And they go against each other. So this is a optical phonon in sapphire that you're seeing the aluminum atoms going one way and the oxygen atoms going a different way. And so one thing is you can already see that these optical phonons, they can have translational invariance, so they have zero momentum, but they still have energy. So you have a gap. And that gap means that you can match very well light mass, dark matter. So that's what I'm showing here. If I have dark matter, so this is the dark matter dispersion relation on a parabola. It's up here. It can drop down to zero, and it can release all of its energy and momentum to that optical phonon state. So they're kinematically matched very well. So let's see using this. So in particular, the optical phonon is very good at seeing anything that is coupling via a dark photon or is the dark photon itself. And you can just see that by looking here. So if I have a polar crystal like gallium arsenide or like sapphire, when that optical phonon is going through your system, in this case, the aluminum atoms are going in one direction, the oxygen is going the other. So this really is an electric dipole. So the electric dipole goes like this. So it's going to couple very strongly to infrared photons. And that's why we actually call it an optical phonon. In that sapphire crystal that if you have a ring made out of sapphire, it's completely transparent, right? You don't see any light. But if we looked at it in infrared, we would start to see these very strong bands where the crystal is just completely black. So if the crystal is black to infrared, then it also then is going to be black to anything that couples via the dark photon, if you kinematically match. So these are some plots here, which show, let's say, for example, here's your sapphire. So here we're bouncing off that sapphire line. And so this is a different, so now we're looking at interactions with the electron on the y-axis. But again, you can go way below the Friesen line with kilogram year exposures.
Sorry, what happens to the supernova bombs here?
I don't know.
Large cross sections. If you're in 10 to minus 36, that is probably getting thermalized. The problem is
the problem is
cosmology.
Yes, yeah, going to ask the next one. Yeah,
we couldn't find any good models.
Yeah. So
I thought the freezing for a million because it's milli charge, right?
Freezing is
okay. I think there's VPN bounds. In order for the dark photon thermalized, you need a mixing of 10 minus 9 or something. So I think it's above the freezing line, maybe. That's why I'm saying that the mixing, kinetic mixing, when you go down that plot, must be close to 10 to the minus 14. So I don't see why the supernova is not here.
Supernova should be higher.
It's higher here? Because MKI is like a miniature particle. So if you are at the below an MeV or 10 MeV, and the freezing line is about to mix in over 10 minus 11. This is like a...
Epsilon G is 10 to minus
11.
Epsilon times G is 10 to minus 11.
Yeah, epsilon times G is 10 to minus 11, right? So
yeah.
So why isn't this the milli charge?
I think the mediator they want is like almost nothing.
Say that again?
The mediator the dark photon mediator you have is almost massless.
Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah, this is a massless dark matter, dark photon.
No, but if you have a 10 MeV dark matter in a supernova,
bare
this is
in,
yeah, bare production. This is the millichar stuff.
I thought that was higher.
Afterwards we can actually look at, I know a paper that actually has those.
Okay.
So we can actually pull the paper out afterwards.
Mina is right, it's part of this plot, must be excluded by supernova.
You're saying this is not the supernova line, you think some of this is below?
Somewhere from maybe below there, but this should be to the bottom of the plot where the stellar bounds are. It should be somewhere in the blob of the lines, there should be a...
Oh, there should be a lower bound, or?
There should be some, like similar to what you had before, there should be some band in that region that where supernova are, below masses of MK of 10 MeV, and...
That, okay.
The cross sections though, there and at low energy are different, right? So.
No, I know, but maybe, yes. But,
this is some V to the 4, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Continue.
We can look at the paper because I think where I pulled this plot from, there's also plots for the other one. So we can pull it and we can see. I mean,
okay.
I'd be surprised if they did the constraints on the nucleon scattering and not on the electron scattering from the same paper. But
if you're going to cover it later, then don't bother responding. But in your choice of all these crystals, some of them I noticed have been, you know, used at CREST or CREST trial run type experiments.
Yep.
How did you choose these crystals?
Yes, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So we hear we're talking about phonons that are like order 10 MeV, 50 MeV momentum also?
No. So momentum is, it can be up to kV scale, right? So energies we quote, but momentums are always, it's a crystal.
Yeah,
so it's always zero to a few kV.
Okay, great.
And you talk about how you measure a 10 MeV, a 1 MeV, MeV thing.
I will say how one could scale down to that in the R&D section, which we're almost to.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so other channels. So far I've only looked at the vibration, the phonon production channels. There are, of course, two other channels that we all know. There's the inelastic electron recoil dark matter channel, where you're inelastically scattering off of electron, let's say, in the semiconductor. And again, you're actually playing this trick. But this is the band diagram for silicon. And you see that it's actually indirect gap. And so it actually just turns out that for dark matter of MeV scale, it actually perfectly kinematically matches to the indirect gap in silicon. If you have a dark matter particle with MeV mass, you basically have kV momentum, and you have EV scale energy. So there's perfect matching. And so so this is what we use as well in all sorts of experiments. So SINSAY, HVEV, super CMS HVEV are looking for inelastic electron recoils. Then we have the it means exactly this. So here I have momentum in these crazy units, which is just think of this as, you have a three-dimensional Berlin zone, and so gamma is going to be the zero momentum, and then these are just delta, chi, k, sigma. Those are different points on this crystal three-dimensional Berlin zone. And so these are lines from zero to gamma. So this is just, we're mapping out a three-dimensional momentum space on a 2D plot. So this is just momentum and energy. And anyway, so what we see is that this is your lowest occupied band. So this is your lowest, this is your highest energy valence. So all this is all occupied. All these states are all occupied in your cold crystal. And then this is your lowest unoccupied energy state. So this is actually why in silicon, why does your silicon solar cell have to be pretty thick? So if you think of like how a solar cell works, it's 50 microns thick, right? It's somewhere 50 and 250 microns. Like that's the size of a wafer if you put solar cells on the top of your home. It's not a micron thick. And why is it not? Because when that 1.1 eV photon comes in, it doesn't interact with it. It doesn't interact via a direct gap. The momentum and energy, so a phonon, a photon, a 1 eV photon, has very little momentum. So it's really sitting here. So for you to absorb that photon, you actually also have to kick out a phonon. So that's the indirect gap. And that's why your silicon solar cell has to be pretty thick. So gallium arsenide, by contrast, is direct gap. And so gallium arsenide absorbs photons very, very quickly. So your 1.5 eV photon will be absorbed within a few microns of gallium arsenide. So one of the claims for like very thin solar cells is if you can make a super nice gallium arsenide film a few microns thick, you could do very well, right?
How expensive are your roof?
Yeah. So that is the problem. This is a different issue. I was at Stanford like during the startup craze, and like I almost like right when I graduated, I actually was gonna go straight out and just do exotic like semiconductors. For photovoltaics, but right before that, it all crashed out. If you guys remember, and the reason is because silicon crystal solar cells just became so cheap. So it used to be 10 years ago, like for a solar cell, a silicon solar cell that could absorb a watt, it would cost something like $6. And now, you know, China is just amazing at building shit, right? And so now it's something like 40 cents a watt for solar cells. And in fact, not that this is my talk, but it turns out that actually your solar cell on top of your home, it's actually the silicon part of it is not the expense. So it still costs something like $2.50 per watt to put solar cells on your house. But all of that cost is in like the glass and in the installing it. It's not in the solar cell itself. The solar cell itself is now something like 25% of the total cost. And so once you transition to that area, then all of the startups died. And so yeah, so it's unlikely we'll ever make a gallium arsenide startup. But you know, if you could, you could use very, very thin gallium arsenide solar cells because it's direct gap. That was a huge aside. Okay, so of course, now there's optical IR heliscopes, which you guys have been the leaders on. And again, this is, now here you're trying to match the momentum and energy of dark matter via using multiple different crystal layers. So you're making like a metacrystal with a different translational symmetry to match very well the momentum and energy of dark matter. But you know, to first order, the ideas are again roughly similar. You need very good energy resolution, and you need no dark counts. So in that sense, every one of these interaction rates is basically telling you you want to make a detector which has as low energy resolution as possible, with no dark counts, and you can look for vibrations. You can look for photons for optical IR telescopes. You can look for inelastic electron recoil dark matter in silicon. All these are different paths we could go down. So now let's talk about building a detector with single sensitivity, with sensitivity to a single phonon or to a single electron hole pair or to a single photon without using Luknev-Ganov gain like HVEB. So in particular, the optical phonons have by far the most constraints. So optical phonon, so the phonon detector is the most constraints. So what do we know? We know that at 300 Kelvin, all the atoms are vibrating around with on average 25 milliev of energy. So if you're looking for a 25 milliev deposition, you absolutely can't do it at room temperature, right? So that's just the first thing we know. We have to go cold. And that means obviously we should use some kind of superconducting detector technology. So both MKIDs and transition edge sensors, we have applications for athermal phonons, and we know how to build them. For superconducting nanowires, they're really only good for photon applications. So I'm going to talk mostly here about transition and sensors. However, almost everything I say could be directly applied to MKIDS in a one-to-one level. So just keep track of that. I'm going to talk via transit TSs, but either one is okay. So now, how do we see these small vibrational energy depositions? Well, so we'll just go through what a TS is. So a transition edge sensor is basically just a little calorimeter. Energy goes in, it heats up this metal film. And then the resistance of that metal film, if we artificially bias it within its transition, when it's heated up, its resistance will change by a huge amount. And we'll see that resistance change as a change in current going through the device. So that's great. So now we say, well, let's do a whole array of just TSs. And we try to look for interactions directly within the TS. And the problem is this energy resolution is going to scale as the heat capacity. So it scales as basically CKBT squared. And so if it scales with the heat capacity, you have to use very low TC, but also you have to use very small volumes. So you know your transition edge sensor is going to be a small volume device. And therefore you say, well, so if I want to look for nuclear recoils off of the TS itself, is it possible to get Gram day exposures? And so let's say I use a TS, which is 25 micron by 25 micron by 40 nanometers. Well, that's just 500 femtograms. So you would need a huge array of them, right? So basically, it's impossible. I know that they actually did a calculation like this with the superconducting nanowires, where they actually said, what is our dark matter constraint? And it was, of course, bad, right? Because they're talking about a femtogram detector. So if you really want to look for these interactions, you have to somehow couple this sensor to a big volume. So the second most simple thermal calorimeter one could use is where you have this electronic heat capacity of the TS, and it's somehow thermally coupled to like a giant absorber. So this is an insulating absorber. So it has very low heat capacity because it's an insulator. The heat capacity scales as T cubed. So as you go to low T, the heat capacity goes to zero. And the idea would then be that you put energy into the absorber. Somehow that energy gets into the TS, and you measure it. So this has been around since roughly the 80s. You know, you can sort of think of like Quore. You can think of all these experiments that have used NTDs. It's basically this idea that you somehow put something into the to a big crystal absorber and you read it out. So this isn't new. So what is the problem with making this system really, really sensitive? And the problem is we need to make this heat capacity very, very small. So we go to very low energies, very low temperatures. But when we go to very low temperatures, this is an electronic system. So we need to get the energy into the electronic system. But here, we wanted to have this huge heat capacity, so we know we're putting it only into the vibration system because there is no electronic system here. So we have to somehow get that vibrational energy into the TS. But the interaction between these, so that's this electron-phonon interaction, and it scales as like T to the 4. So the problem with this basic simple idea is that in my TS that's on the surface of this giant crystal, it's really decoupling. And I put energy in here, it bounces around, and before it gets up here, it's going to go out and go into my housing, and it's going to dissipate. So I can't get my energy into my sensor. And this is why all these detectors have always had really bad energy resolution. So how do we get around that? And it's that we're going to use athermal phonon sensor technology.
Core has good energy resolution.
No, it has 7 kV.
No. It depends on what energy range. If it's in a few kV, that's a sub kV energy.
No, it does not. I literally was just talking with Quora yesterday. They have
lots of their lines that are less than a kV across.
No, they have 5 kV.
No.
No?
Absolutely.
No, they don't. I promise you. I was part of the Quora collaboration.
Well, I can show you then your previous papers where you see the bumps, let's say, from calcium that like...
No, the lines are even worse. So their baseline energy resolution is 5 kV on their crystals. It's 5 to 7 kV. and their lines at higher.
It depends on what energy range.
So your baseline energy resolution is always better than your energy resolution at 3 MeV. And the reason why is at 3 MeV, you also start to pick up position-dependent effects. So I just care about what's near threshold. But your resolution at zero energies is always less than your resolution at 10K, at 100 kV, at an MeV. And Core, in some sense, doesn't really care about their baseline resolution. And I'll tell you why. And it's because their actual energy, so they're looking at something, I don't know, like what's the Q value for tellurium? It's probably something like, it's like 2400 kV, right? So it's like 2.4 MeV. So it actually turns out that their baseline resolution is lower than their resolution at 2400 kV. And the reason why is because they're limited by some kind of positional effects that they don't quite understand. And so their width at 2400 is somewhere around 7 kV. It's always around 7 kV for all of their devices. And it's somehow some kind of position dependence that they're never able to get down, that they're never able to lower. So in fact, they purposely said, there's no reason for me to go to a smaller crystal. So they were choosing between, I don't know, a 5 cm by 5 cm by 5 cm crystal and a 2 cm by 2 cm by 2 cm crystal and just have more of them. And they're like, why don't we use smaller crystals? Because then they have better energy resolution. And they don't go because they're limited by position dependent effects anyway. So it doesn't matter.
If I open a paper with Core Zero or Coroutina and I go to the low energy part of the spectrum, I can see the lines around 4 kV energy with the sub kV energy.
You can't. You just can't. So I don't know what paper you're looking at.
The paper is all made up. I can.
No. I mean I was part of that collaboration. So you're not right. You're not right. Yeah. It's just
yeah,
it's just facts. So anyway, so this is what we want to do. We want to not have this problem of this decoupling. So how do we get around that? So we're going to take these phonons. They're going to be bouncing, but they start out as high energy phonons. And as they bounce around, they start to thermalize and they start to go from one phonon, they go through an anharmonic decay process and they go into two phonons. So what we want to do is we want to catch this phonon before he thermalizes all the way down to low energies. And so if we can catch him when he's a 10 Kelvin phonon, he's going to interact in our films as if he's 10 Kelvin. So he has a very high interaction rate. So what we want to do is we want to bounce this phonon around, this high energy phonon, and we're going to absorb him in an aluminum thin before he decays below the superconducting band gap. That aluminum thin will then take a Cooper pair, it'll break it up into two quasiparticles, and all the energy of that phonon will go into the quasiparticles. Those quasiparticles diffuse, and eventually they heat our TS. So this is what we would call an athermal phonon sensor. And this is how we collect athermal phonons. So it's really this idea that we're going to collect and concentrate this vibrational energy into our phonon sensor before it thermalizes completely. And that's how we get around the problem of this electron phonon coupling at 10 mK. OK, so now let's think about these ideas of athermal excitation detectors and volume scaling. Because I grant that these are a little bit weird, but let's just think about how these things scale with volume. And so we're going to go and we're going to think about a standard PMT and oscillator. Acetylene crystal, or think of Bohr casino. And we're going to ask the question, is the energy resolution, so I have a PMT on this one and that one, and this one has a much bigger volume. So the question is will these have the same energy resolution, these two detectors? And the answer is they will. Even though I'm reading out a much bigger volume, they'll have the same energy resolution if I meet these two criteria. So if I have a reflector in which that photon is not absorbed when it hits an uninstrumented area, and it just reflects and it continues to bounce around, then eventually I'm going to, in both of these cases, I'll eventually absorb that photon. And of course, the other constraint is that you can't have an absorption in the volume, right? So these are just two simple ideas, but this is at the core of like an excitation detector. And so all of your understanding of PMT in this case will also work for us with an athermal phonon detector. So the same rules apply in that now I just go from being a PMT and oscillator to an athermal phonon sensor and our crystal detector. And if I can bounce this around for a much longer period of time. So here is our athermal phonon excitation detector. So I have a large TES over here with a huge number of phonon sensors. And now I'm very likely to, so I say every time this phonon hits a surface, what is the probability of that surface having a phonon sensor on it? It's going to be higher on the left than the right. But my energy sensitivity scales with the size of the TS, with the number of TSs I put on my surface. So if I want to decrease the energy if I want to increase the energy sensitivity, decrease the baseline resolution, I want to drop the number of TSs substantially. So I want to go from that system to this system. But that means I have to bounce that phonon for longer and longer periods of time before he thermalizes. So this trick we're going to play is we really want to bounce that phonon forever. And if we can, then we can go to a smaller and smaller coverage, and we can keep that very nice energy resolution of a very small TS. And that's the trick we're going to play in all of our detectors. And this is what actually, in some sense, separates us from super-CDMS. Super-CDMS is made for a high-mass dark matter search, and they want to have position dependence. And so they want to put an enormous number of phonon sensors all over their detector so they can get X, Y, and Z information, and they can fiducialize. But what I'm showing you here is that that fiducialization signal is fundamentally against this idea of going to ultra-low energies. So if you want to go to ultra-low energies, you're going to have to bounce that phonon for a large period of time because you want this to be as small as you can. So this is so we can actually just think about this. And this leads to a scaling law for energy resolution versus your detector technology. And here is your phonon energy resolution of your TS. It scales as 4kb t squared g, and g, which we talked about earlier, scales as t to the fourth. So that means your noise in your TS scales as t to the sixth, or your baseline resolution scales as tc cubed. So if we continue to lower, so here is our detector in which my signal, in which I'm in this regime, where my signal bounces around a huge number of times, and therefore my bandwidth of my signal, so my the time to collect is the bandwidth is 1 over tau collection. So I have a very long tau collection, and here's my sensor. My sensor has a much faster bandwidth. It has a much, if I with the exponential on my sensor by itself, I put a jitter in it, it'll be very quick. And if I lower my TC of my TS, which I see here going from my red is a high TC device with very high bandwidth. If I start lowering my TC, my noise of my TS starts to go down very rapidly, and I start to have excellent energy resolution. And so I can always have the volume of the TS times TC cubed scaling in principle. So we want to make very small volume, very low TC devices to have excellent energy resolution. So the problem with all of this is that to make this curve viable, we need to bounce this phonon hundreds and thousands of times. And we see some problems in that even in silicon, those phonons will downconvert on the surface and they'll thermalize. And so if our surface is very dirty and covered with carbon or neon gas, so here they evaporated neon on the surface, they saw that the scattering probability to decay away was something like, you know, at 0.1, something like 1 in 50. And so in this case, you could only bounce that phonon 50 times before he downconverts. So if we use very clean silicon with nothing on it, we should be able to get to something like one bounce in every, you know, something like 0.2%. So if we cover just 0.2% or 0.3% of the detector surface, we should be able to collect almost all of the athermal phonons before they decay away. So that sets the scale that we can do with silicon. And we've gone down in CDMS to something like 1% coverage. But we really, to go that next step down, we really have to go to something like 1 in 1,000. We really have to cover a very small percentage of our surface to get very high energy resolution. Okay, so that's the basic goal of our athermal phonon devices. So now let's go through a little bit of where we are in our R&D. So this is just how far we achieved in making an ultra-sensitive TS. So here is actually the mask we've been testing recently. So this is not the big athermal phonon sensor. It's just the TS portion, so it's a square. The device that we're going to show, so this device should have, its energy resolution should scale as C kBT squared. And this is at volume. So we're testing right now the 400 by 100 micron by 40 nanometer TS, which is circled in the bottom right. And it has a TC of 41 millik. So to set the scale, so here's the bias power of that device. It's something like 35 femtowatts. So of course, CMB, if you're in a CMB experiment, and in a spider, SPT, they all use TSs. So they're using TSs with something like picowatt bias powers. So there's something like 25 or 40 times larger bias powers than we use. So these are very, very sensitive TSs fundamentally. Here's the fall time. It's 64 microseconds. It's a relatively slow fall time, 2.4 kilohertz. And here's the noise we see. This is just all measured. This is our noise power. And here's our bandwidth. So what is our energy resolution? It's something like 40 milliev is our fundamental energy resolution of this device, of this 400 by 100 sensor. So this is just the TS part. So this is if we put energy directly into TS, as if we had a photon being absorbed. So now why am I showing you the 100 by 400 device and not these other two devices that are on the same plot, the 200 by 50? I've just shown that the energy resolution scales with the square root of the volume. So if we can get 40 milliev with this, then we should absolutely be able to get 20 milliev with this one. And we should be able to get 10 milliev with this device. Right? Like that's what we should be able to do. So what's happened? Well, the bias powers scale with the area. So if this device has 35 femtowatts, this device will have 9 femtowatt bias power. This will have 2 femtowatts. And what we see is this device here is just always normal. So we're putting environmental power into the system at the 5 femtowatt level. So that is our current experimental limits. And that's why we can't do 10 milliev photon detectors at the present moment. So so what is the solution here? Well, we have to get rid of this EMI, this power that's going down these bias lines. Those lines have to be there. We have to read out the signal. So we have to somehow open our Faraday cage to get signals in and out. It's just the way of the world. And so what we have to do is improve the filtering at every stage of this Faraday cage. So here we have nice filtering of high frequency EMI from, your cell phone. If you put your cell phone in, we used to see glitches. Like every time you're talking to the cell phone, you would see it in our detector. Right? The kids would get out of classrooms and suddenly the detector would start going crazy. Clearly that means we don't have enough filtering, right? So we've got into 40 milliev, but to go further, we're gonna have to improve our filtering further. I think this is viable. We're currently in the process of building a filter at the 10 millik stage in which we should suppress these backgrounds by something like 80 dB is the theory. Like this is a filter that John Clark has been using for in his superconducting quantum information and qubit devices for a while. So we're basically just stealing that design, and it should have a very high filter of all EMI above something like 500 megahertz. So if this is above 500 megahertz noise, we should be able to get rid of it, and it won't directly hit our device. So here are actually some plots. This is actually a square wave that we see from a cell phone. This is actually a cell phone hitting one of our detectors. The cell phone signal is 2 gigahertz. So this is more like a bunch of 2 gigahertz signals, and this is just the overall heating from all those cell phone signals hitting us in our band, in our bandwidth. So this is the biggest problem for things like the IR heliscope that we have to improve on if we really want to go down. So now, let's say our current energy resolution is 40 milliev, how could we go to 1 milliV? Well, if we go, let's say, just 40 to 10, that these things scale as, so this device won't scale as T cubed because it's not the phonons. It'll just scale as T to the 3/2. So you would go from 40 to 10, you would get times 8 sensitivity. And then we would lower the volume by 16 from here to here, and we would get times 4 improvement. Of course, to do that, really what we're limited by is neither of those. It's by this decreasing the environmental noise by something like 50 dB. So if we can do that, then we can actually make this 1 milliV device. Like that's the R&D path towards a detector which has 1 milliV resolution for a photon. So it is theoretically viable. It just depends on can we decrease that environmental noise over the next 5 years by filtering. Okay, and at that point, you've now made your optical halo-scope sensor that has very low energy resolutions. Okay, so now let's continue on with the phonon detectors. So now we have to make the athermal phonon sensor. So this entire process here isn't 100% efficient. So if you have this phonon energy, only a fraction of that phonon energy eventually gets here. First off, when you break this quasiparticle into Cooper pairs, it releases subgap phonons. So something like only 50% of the energy goes into the Cooper pair system. So that's a 50% hit you take right there. Then let's say only half of those quasiparticles actually make it to the TS. That's another 50%. And you're down to what we currently have, which is something like 20%. So we could attempt to work on going from the 20% to 40%. That is the other path we could go down to really improve our devices. I guess arguably you could think of, you can actually do better than just this naive factor of 2. And it's because if you can improve this transmission quality, you can make these fins really, really long. And therefore, you can collect a certain instrumented area with the same size TS, but a much larger area. And that's what we need, right? Because we need to collect that phonon before he bounces. So that would be the second step is really to optimize this phonon sensor. So then we have to fabricate things on crystals. Of course, is step 3. And now I'll talk to you about where our current limit is for big giant crystals. And that is, it's all coming from this 3-inch wafer that's 1 millimeter thick that we put little phonon sensors down. And there's something like 1,000 phonon sensors there in that picture. And we originally made this actually as a scintillation detector for next generation Core. So I've collaborated with Yuri, who leads the American Core group, in developing this detector to look for like Cherenkov radiation off of tellurium oxide. And that would be able to give you ER NR discrimination. So that was the original idea for this detector. And let's just look at its performance. Here it is.
Tellurium.
Yeah. So tellurium is only Cherenkov. Of course, if you want to use a different material, it'll give you scintillation at the kV scale. But they need something like 10 eV energy resolution to make next generation crystal-based neutrino double beta decay experiments work, which will have ER NR discrimination. So this is the device. It's something like 3 inches big. It's 1 millimeter thick. It has athermal phonon sensors all over it. Here is its energy resolution. It's a 40 millik device. Here you can see the bias power is actually really here, huge compared to that little small TS that I just showed. It's something like 4 picowatts. Here is its performance. Here is the TSs, and here's the TS fault time. It's pretty fast. It's 60 microsecond. Here are actual phonon pulses. And you see the fault time is 20 microseconds. It's a little too fast. If we wanted to bandwidth match and make that phonon bounce longer period of times, it would actually have better resolution. So this device was not made completely correctly per the optimization scheme we talked about earlier. The noise here is worse by something like a factor of 1.52.
Out of power?
Oh, I should have plugged my laptop in. So the noise of that device is something like a factor of 2 off its theoretical energy resolution. And its energy resolution is 4 EV. So, you know, in terms of the energy resolutions that we've been talking about for large volume detectors, it really is a marvel, right? It's 4 EV sigma PT, you know, compared to CDMS dark matter detection of 200 EV, compared to KEV scale Core. We can discuss if it's KEV or 10 KEV, but you know, this is a 4 E, this is a 4 EV device. No. I mean, you know, we can. This is something we can bet a beer on it.
Dinner for all of us.
Yeah, exactly. I'm willing to make that bet. Okay, and a second here. Awesome. So here is our
Very dumb question.
Yep.
You're talking about energy resolution. Are you talking about this? Are you equating the resolution to threshold?
Yeah. So you should always multiply. So actually, you should multiply the 4 EV here by 4.5, and that's our threshold. So this is a 16 EV nuclear recoil energy threshold.
Okay.
So everywhere. So if you're looking at threshold, that's why. Yeah, if you want a 100 milliEV threshold, you need something like a 20 milliEV baseline resolution. Okay, so we actually have a dark matter search, which I was almost certain I would be able to present to you the limits of. I will say the limits are amazing. So you should expect them to be world leading from the search, and it's actually world leading at the 20 gram day scale at the surface. So that's the amazing thing. This space really is, you know, it's really wide open. You can do surface runs with devices with 4 EV resolution, you know, well away from what we were talking about earlier, which is like, how does one get 100 milliEV resolution, 100 milliEV thresholds? Even 4 EV thresholds for nuclear recoils are, you know, there are virtually no limits down there. So I will say, actually, just now, we took this to we shipped this device to Qt, which is an undergrad cryostat at Snow Lab. And this exact device here that's shown. And he is cooling right now as we speak. And hopefully we'll improve the energy resolution, the noise in the underground cryostat. So part of the reason why we're doing this is actually to like make sure the noise in that cryostat is as good as we can get above ground. And then once we do that, we'll also run a dark matter search below ground with him. And hopefully that would start in early January, would be this device with 4 EV resolution. So finally, that device there was clearly not optimized for a dark matter search. It was really made for photon collection. Because it has a very large area and a very small volume. And you know, we want large volume for dark matter searches in very small areas, because then we have to instrument a small area. So you really want spheres for a dark matter search, but you know, you can't fabricate a sphere, so you really want to make a cube. So roughly you can say, well, what could we do? And this is basically with our 100 by 400. So we know that we have our environmental noise down to the point of like, you know, in a 100 by 400 micron device of 40 milliEV. And then, you know, we say we have fractional coverage of 1%. We can get roughly 20% efficiencies. So here we've simulated it out to 19%. And that gives you, you know, 220 milliEV resolution, baseline resolution, or EV scale detectors. So we think that for cubes, just based on the idea of PD2 and based on what we've done with the small TSs, we're at the EV thresholds right now. And that means that we can do inelastic electron recoil dark matter on silicon, hopefully within the next year, without any Luc-Neganoff gain. Just pure phonon energies. And that's that first step. So how would one run these devices in a cryostat below ground? You know, a below ground cryostats are very expensive. So we would somehow like to take a spot in the Super CDMS cryostat at Snow Lab. And how could one sort of remake that cryostat to match our needs? Well, we need an active veto around that, you know, a bunch of sodium iodide 3 inches thick all around our detectors. So that's the first thing we would have to add to the Super CDMS system. And then we just would have to toss our detectors inside. So we could potentially do this cheaply.
Can I ask you, I mean, is it enough to put an active veto of the usual backgrounds? Can backgrounds create defects that later on decay and create forms out of time so that you cannot correlate the...
So yes, let's go through this. So if that background is created, so if it hits your detector itself, and then you know, per that idea of flat backgrounds, we think that the vast majority of that stuff is going to like shoot out a huge energy photon, let's say, if it's a high energy photon, then it'll fly away from your crystal and it'll have to be absorbed. If it's absorbed in your crystal, it's way out of your band. So you need to somehow
transfer the energy.
You need to somehow get only a very small energy deposition in your tiny crystal, and it's sort of hard to do.
You mean if you create defects, can defects in the crystal, let's say, you dislocate a nucleus and later on that.
So these things are really really cold, right? So let's just think, let's say you make a Frenkel defect, and then somehow you're saying that thing tunnels back and it gives you 15 eV of energy. Let's say hypothetically.
Part of it goes to phonons. Can it go to phonons?
So that would, but I mean that right there actually tells you exactly what to get rid of that, to get rid of any kind of Frenkel defect thing. Then if you look below 15 eV, you won't have it. Because you know exactly how much energy is being released is exactly the energy of that tunneling. So I think this is actually, you know, the rule is not the same as with flat backgrounds, but it's still roughly this idea. There should always be an energy scale where things like that won't affect you. And there should be a clean spectrum. And that's because, a Frenkel defect has, you know, it has to kick out 15 eV of energy. So I think there's always going to be a space there where we should be okay. So for stuff that comes from other detectors, we just use an active photon veto. So I think it's really this idea of I would say it's not this idea of going underground that's the problem in scaling up. It's the problem of making that one detector with 100 milliEV thresholds or EV thresholds. That's where the real technical challenge is. I think scaling it up and putting underground, I think that's solvable. We can talk later about the other ones, but yeah, a Frenkel defect is 15 EV. So you know you can't make sub EV stuff. Okay, so I here's the summary, I guess, overall. Hopefully, I've shown you the scaling laws for how one could get to 100 milliEV photon absorption and 100 milliEV dark matter. And I've certainly shown that we already have energy resolutions needed for GeV scale. So we talked about our big, large area detector, which has 4 eV resolution and has nuclear recoil dark matter sensitivities at thresholds at something like 16 eV. And then I talked about the 100 micron by 400 micron TS chip, which has something like 40 milliEV resolution right now, or something like thresholds for single photons directly absorbed of 200 milliEV right now. Or if we put that into an athermal phonon detector, it's something like EV scale athermal phonon recoil energies. And then the R&D plan is you know, in some sense simple. It's just increase the TS sensitivity by lowering TC, improve the collection area, and optimize that tungsten aluminum interface to improve actually the athermal phonon sensor design, and then find a crystal that has very nice phonon surface thermalization. So it has very little phonon surface thermalization. So that would be what we would need for the optical phonon dark matter. And that's it. So there was one question I missed, which was, so CREST has already done sapphire, and CREST does calcium tungstate. So actually, I think there were curves for calcium tungstate shown. So why don't they have the energy resolution needed to do something like this? They use TSs. So their energy resolution is worse than ours. So in their big photon detector, which is silicon on sapphire, I don't know the slide, but they have something like a 5 eV photon resolution in something like a 4 centimeter square device. And we're getting 4 eV in 45 centimeters. So we have actually better resolution than they have. And I've just unfortunately told you that this should scale as TC cubed, and they actually have 15 millikTCs. So like they should actually be, something like 20 times better resolution than they are. And they don't see the scaling law that one would naively think they should. So this has been a mystery to us in our collaboration, like why isn't CREST better than they are? And we don't really know the answer. We think that they're just limited. Though it's difficult to talk with them because they don't speak the same language that we speak in terms of all of these like technical plots that we use to understand our complex impedance. So CMB, X-ray, so everyone in the TS community except for CREST speak the same language. CREST is somewhere by themselves. So you can't really talk with them about their energy resolution because they don't have an understanding of it. But we think what's happened is exactly what's happened here in our devices. So this device here, we can run. This device is normal. So we think they have this device that has amazing sensitivity, and they found that it was just normal. So clearly that would mean they'd have to work on their environmental noise. But they're like, oh, we actually don't understand the environmental noise and how it scales. So rather than try to put better filters on, let's just put a gold wire bond from here to the housing and increase the G substantially to like cool this film down and take all the heat away from that power going in. But the problem is then you have thermal fluctuations along that gold wire bond, which then boost up your energy resolution by a factor of 25. So our current best understanding of CREST, which I grant is just a hypothesis, they have told us that they do put an extra gold wire bond to the housing. And so we think the reason is because they couldn't run detectors even of this scale without just heating it up. So they put this extra coupling, and then now the system is really noisy. So we think that's what's happened, and we think that's why they're not 20 times more sensitive than they should be. And that's why they can't look for single phonons. So in some sense, they are like us, I would say, except we have a plan of how to improve our filtering, and they don't. So that would be my rough understanding of CREST. In some sense, we are going down the CREST path in terms of going to very polar crystals to look for these single optical phonons. Guess one more. So the other possibility is that all the crystals they've used are just really bad at thermalization on the surface. So because we've never seen their data, they should be able to very easily orthogonalize the system. And like we, for example, can split up and say, what is our collection efficiency? It's 20% in our devices. And we can split that from the noise. So we can say, this is our noise. And we can say it's approximately, it's a factor of 2 off of our fundamental limit. And then we can say, what is our energy resolution? Well, it's a noise times by, your collection efficiency. So 1 over your collection efficiency, and it gives you a penalty factor. And we can split those 2 up. Like we can directly measure our collection efficiency by looking at calibration of here a 1.5 kV aluminum line. We can say how much energy went into the TS. We can directly measure that. And that's how we get the 17% athermal phonon sensitivity. So they don't split the noise up from the signal. So the other possibility is their noise isn't as bad. It's not 25 times worse. Maybe it's 5 times worse than it should be. And just their crystals thermalize all of their athermal phonon signal very, very quickly. So that's the other possibility. They're just unlucky, and they've chosen sapphire, and they've chosen calcium tungstate, which have very bad surface downconversion. And then the solution is, well, you don't want to use sapphire, and you don't want to use calcium tungstate. You want to use things like silicon dioxide instead. And you just have to, we have to figure out what crystal, and it's just going through and just trying to figure out what crystal actually has good, has very low surface downconversion. And that's something that we don't actually have any theoretical understanding of. We don't know what crystals will be better or worse intrinsically. I'm sure that some condensed matter physicists probably has some inkling. We've talked to a few of them, and the majority just say surfaces are really nasty, and they're not really willing to play in that area. So we do have a few at LBL that are trying to work on this and trying to tell us what crystals we should look at first to have that will have minimum athermal phonon downconversion. The ones we do know are good are silicon and germanium. We know those have less than 1% downconversion on the surface. So that was CREST. Okay, any other questions? Other than Quarry's energy resolution. Okay.